Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am Reggie Darden, and today I have a great guest with me, Mr. Dan Meck. And yeah, we're going to get into some Kenpo talk and some martial arts talk, and maybe get into some teaching and, you know, whatever else that we decide to get into. So yes, we'll turn it over to my guest. Well, actually, let me go back here a little bit. I usually go into my background, and we kind of discussed this a little bit before we started recording. But just the quick cliff notes is, you know, I have advanced ranks in Kenpo and in Capoeira, and not so advanced ranks in Taekwondo and Hapkido and did some boxing. So that's just the super quick version of my background, and yeah, we'll get into more as we go along. But Mr. Meck here, go ahead and tell me and the listeners how Kenpo found you, how where did it all start for you, how did you get started, and yeah, we'll just go from there.
Okie dokie. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me on here. When you were giving me your history, one thing I did say prior to that I want to put out there is that I think it's absolutely terrific, this endeavor that you're undertaking. Anybody who is willing to go out there and try and document Kenpo in any way, shape, or form, get the word out, speak positive about Kenpo. I'm all in, my man. I'm all in. And as we were just getting to know each other, one thing that anybody who knows me knows is that I am blessed with the gift of gab. So let's rock and roll. All right. So you asked me how I started in Kenpo. So I will tell you this. When I was in fourth grade, I was your stereotypical case where I was the worst kid in class. I was the worst kid in fourth grade. I was the kid with the desk next to the teacher. I was the kid that had like parent-teacher conferences when there were no other kids, where their parents were coming. It was just Danny's mom had to come in and talk to the teacher, could be like, you understand just how misbehaved your son is, you know? So that's where I was with that. And on top of that, I, you know, I was lacking in confidence. I believe now that I had raw physical ability, but I just did not have, I was an older brother, you know, I didn't have any real guidance as to how to do any of these things. So bullies had a tendency to get the better of me, and it used to drive my father absolutely bonkers. So anyway, my last day of fourth grade, where I was a wimp getting picked on and I was the worst kid in class, my dad signed me up for karate class. Came home report card days, like one of the worst days in my life back then. I come home on report card day expecting bad news, and I get, well, you know, you're going to be grounded in the summer, but that's okay because you're going to be doing karate. Let's go. You're starting karate right now. It was June 21st, 1985, my very first lesson. It was in a Tracy school. So I learned, at the time it was called kimono grab. I learned front kick, horse stance, inward block, things like that. And, you know, and that's how we got started. And karate really, really stuck. You know, karate was one of these things. If I go backwards a little bit, I'll tell another story. When I was in kindergarten, we were sitting around in a circle. I'll never forget this. This is an embarrassment that you remember for your whole life. The teacher asked, she goes, what skills do you guys have? I had no skills. Although I didn't think. I was bilingual. I spoke Spanish and English. I could have gone out there and whipped out Spanish. That was no big thing to me. I thought everybody did. I thought everybody spoke Spanish. Everybody in my world did. You know, so I lied. I said I know karate. And I went out in the middle of the floor and I started busting out my moves. And I can just still to this day, I'm 49 years old, I can still remember the feeling of going, they're just not buying it. So karate was always in me, you know. I mean, I remember my friend said to me one day, he's like, hey, man, you want to come to this movie? This movie, Karate Kid. I watched Karate Kid. It blew me away. I saw that movie three times in the theater. You know, I was 8 years old or whatever. A kid's name was Daniel in the movie. Daniel, I mean, that works out for me. I've been Daniel-san my whole life as a result. All my whole life, Daniel-san. I've been called that a million times. But, you know, sitting in that movie theater, and it's funny, I remember watching that movie theater. There was a scene in a tournament where, you know, it kind of goes aerial and you see some kids, just one kid in the foreground. I remember looking at that kid going, man, I could do that. I wish I could do that just like that kid, you know? And then here you go. My dad signed me up for karate, you know? Why did he pick Kempo? I was a city kid. I wanted to go to there was a Taekwondo chain we went and looked at. Kids were hitting flying sidekicks. They were doing flying sidekicks on old antifreeze bottles. And I was like, man, that's awesome. I'm gonna learn how to do that kick and kick those things. And my dad goes, no, we're going to this. We're not going to that school. We're going to this other school, Kempo. It was in the suburbs. That's why he just wanted to help move me out of the city. You know, it was the greatest thing my father ever did for me on so many different levels. So that's how I got my start in Kempo. And then the quick wrap to that part of my martial arts career is I went from being the worst kid in class to when I graduated in high school, I had a full academic scholarship. You know, so if you want to talk about discipline, and understanding, and there was an accountability. You know, I was a kid from the city with all these suburban kids. They were getting A's and it was cool. It wasn't cool where I was from, but in karate, it's like, not cool, Danny, you're getting bad grades. It's not cool. You know, I felt that pressure, and I do believe that all that focus learned in those forms and competing in all those tournaments gave me discipline to pay attention to task, and it worked out pretty well for me. So there you go. So there's my history, how I got into Kempo.
Very nice, very nice. So with your, you know, father picking that school, was it, you know, simply because of location, or did he have any kind of knowledge about the arts at that time? Or?
My father had zero understanding of combat arts, zero understanding of combat arts. As a matter of fact, my father worked in a pretty rough neighborhood in West Philadelphia. He was a social worker, so he pretty much just handed out welfare checks, you know, and he would walk to work with a rock in his bag. And one time he showed me his kick. Now I'm teaching karate as a full-time, this time I'm a young adult. And he's like, what do you think? I have this rock here, what if I do this? And I'm telling you, I've seen a lot of sidekicks in my life, and this is definitely one of the worst sidekicks I've ever seen in my life. I'm like, Dad, trust me, just run and make noise. Don't do it, just run and make noise. Because that's the polar opposites that he and I were, you know. I think I kind of took after my mom's side a little more, you know. My mom was a fiery Dominican woman, you know, so I got some of that fire, and I got some of that some of my friends say, some of that flavor, which helped me out, which is beautiful.
Very nice.
So no, it was all about location, 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 location. Get my kid in the suburbs, get him away from the city. That's what did it.
Very nice, very nice. So, you know, when you kind of maybe talk about the early days of your training, you know, was it something that kind of clicked with or connected with, you know, kind of right away? Did you kind of struggle in those early training days, or?
No, I hit the ground running. Matter of fact, this is absolutely the truth. I am not bragging when I say this. This is absolutely the truth. I got the belt right on the first try, and I've been tying it the exact same way from the first time. I got the belt right, you know. And on top of that, my birthday is the same birthday as Bruce Lee. I mean, it's like, it's fate that I get into the arts. Yeah, and on top of that, if my dad was paying for karate, I wasn't going to do anything else. So I was doing karate 5 days a week from the time I was 9 and a half, the last day of fourth grade, to this day. I've been doing karate at least 5 days a week because I wasn't, I'm paying for it. You're doing, how many classes are there? There was no 2-class-a-week limit back then. You show up every day. I was a kid. Oh, here comes Danny again. You know, I took to it. You know, I used to sit down and, you know, I knew short form too when my group was learning long form one. You know, back then we skipped long form two. The theory was that long form two was more difficult than short three. So we went short one, long one, short two, short three. So going from transitioning from short two to short three was pretty difficult. But I had them all figured out. I had them all figured out right away. And I had a pretty good support. I had a lot of really, really good martial artists around me right from the beginning. I was very, very fortunate, the lineage that I came up in. You know, one of my earliest stories, here I am, I'm a white belt. So this is 1985, the summer of 1985. I'm doing short form one. I'm practicing short form one. And this old dude standing in the door, he's old. I don't know where he's from, but he's not from around here. And he's got an accent. And he's going, oh, yay, very good, yeah. I'm like, whatever, dude, I'm a white belt, man. So I start doing. 2 days later, I see him in the back. He's swinging his collies. It was Remy Prices.
Oh, my.
This is Remy Prices. Yeah, man. So that's okay. I mean, he put my face in the mat years later. He got me back for that. He didn't know it. I never admitted it to him, but he demonstrated on me plenty. But, I came up in a school. It was Tracy, Dennis Nackert and Joe Lewis lineage. You know, my original instructor was a guy named Joe Bridenstine. But it was just a good old school. We switched over to Parker in 89. I met Ed Parker in 1989 as a junior black belt. So you're talking about long form three. I watched Ed Parker teach long form three. It's a true story.
Very nice.
So, as you can tell, as I'm turning 49 in a couple of weeks, I still am very passionate about. I'm passionate about it all the way around. All my closest friends are black belts. You know, my wife's a black belt. It's Kempo's my world.
Very nice, very nice.
And the Eagles. I know you said you're from Dallas. I just got to say the Eagles. I don't know if you're a Cowboys fan, but I just got to throw that out. I got to throw an initial bomb in case you're a Cowboys fan.
Got to represent. So yeah, no, I like it. So since you mentioned Remy Prices, so do you have any experience in other arts, or has it just been Kempo for you?
Yeah, I do. I've trained in Kempo. I've trained in the Filipino arts. I've been to the Philippines twice training in the Filipino arts. And then I've also trained in the Burmese style of Bondo, a man by the name of Mong Ji. There was an instructor in the area, an unbelievable martial artist by the name of Ken Coral, who I fought on their team. Bondo Nationals, I fought on their team, and I used to train with my original instructor, Joe Bridenstine, and Dr. G were pretty close, so they used to bring, Joe had some coin to him, that was back in the days, like, I would wear Takedo geese, because I worked for him, he would outfit me real nice, and, you know, his guy had to have all the knowledge, and they needed to beat somebody up, so there was plenty of times where he would bring Mong Ji in for private lessons, and it would be, you know, two of us, four of us maybe, like me and Joe and a couple of his guys, and we would train for hours and hours and hours doing Bondo. So I haven't done any real Bondo since the 90s, but Bondo had an amazing influence on me. It's a tremendous art that not a lot of people have heard of, and at least back then it's kind of seemed to be the way they liked it, some type of a vetting system. But I definitely did that. And then my studio... It was big storefront, big window storefront, not mine, but the one I came up with. It was called American Karate Studios. In the window, it had United States headquarters of International Modern Arnis Federation. What's Arnis? Modern Arnis Federation. And then it had, you know, my instructor painted on the, you know, in all 80s fabulousness, you know, on the window with some sticks and stuff. And then like him throwing, I don't remember what the other one was, him throwing a sidekick for the karate. But yeah, so Filipino stuff, Burmese stuff, and Kempo stuff. Dr. Mong Ji told me a great story one time, if you'll indulge me.
Of course, go ahead.
I was talking to him during one of these lessons. It's just a few of us. I'm in my early 20s. I'm a pretty confident kid. And I looked at Doc and said, Doc, here's the deal. I'm still living in Philadelphia. I guess I just moved out of Philadelphia, but I'm still got a lot of that Philly edge in me. It's worn off after all these years, but a lot of that Philly edge in me. And I said to him, you know, Doc, I can walk through any town in Philadelphia and I'm not nervous. I'm not scared. You know what I mean? Some of the toughest neighborhoods in Philadelphia, those are my cousins. You know, I'm not worried about that. But Chinatown is an area I'm scared about because those guys know something that I don't know. Mong Ji said to me, he goes, well, here's the deal. Now, this was in the 90s. But anyway, he said to me, he goes, listen, the American martial artist has surpassed the Asian martial artist for a few reasons. He goes, number one, the American martial artists have the ability to cross train. You know, he goes, in Asia, it is disrespectful to your instructor, which sidebarred me. I still see people do this, and it's a great business. It's a great business model for retention to keep your students, but it's terrible to keep your students down like that. But anyway, that's just me personally. But anyway, it's disrespectful to leave your instructor so they don't get to cross-train. When you cross-train, you get to diversify your toolbox, you know. And also, Americans question their instructors more than the Asians, you know, which forces quality from the instructors. If you question your instructor, that forces quality from your instructors. So he gave a few reasons like that that I felt were compelling as to why you should cross train. So it was always a philosophy that I stood by. You know, boxing, you said you do boxing, a lot of boxing. You know, I ended up Frank Trejo lineage for many, many years. Frank Trejo was a tremendous, tremendous influence on me. And he was, you know, the fact that he knew a lot of boxing, he'd been a pro boxer, was definitely part of it. But yeah, boxing, kickboxing, Bondo, Arnis, Kali, Kempo. That's what I've been doing. Took one capoeira lesson. One capoeira lesson once. I was Dan the Karate Man at a karate camp back in the day. And they brought a capoeira guy in there. So we did put the music on and we did the dance to the one side and the dance to the other side. And, you know, I mean, I'm from back in the day, only the strong. You know, I could have dug learning a little more of that, but that unfortunately was the only capoeira I got to do.
No, that much like the perfect weapon, only the strong was what got me into capoeira. So, yeah, I can can definitely relate to that. So, yeah, very nice. So,
I'm sorry, you're going to bring stuff up. I told you I have the gift of gab. I'm going to talk. Tell you the perfect weapon, right? We heard about the perfect weapon for a long time before it came out. Jeff Speakman, I saw you interview Jeff Speakman. I didn't get to go to it. Jeff Speakman's a very good man. But anyway, we had a fun weekend with him a few years ago, real fun weekend with him a few years ago. But anyway, we heard about this movie. Jeff Speakman did a tour and all the instructors in the area got to meet him. And Ed Parker came around and he promoted it. Last time he came to Philly, he's promoted it. Called it The Perfect Weapon. I have a movie coming out called The Perfect Weapon, and then unfortunately Mr. Parker passed away. So that movie came out in March of, I think, 1991. I was, what was I, 10th grade at the time? 10th grade. So I saw Perfect Weapon on day two, and that bothered me. I wanted to see it opening night, but we saw it on day two. We went to the movie theater. We showed up to the movie theater, and in there is a guy, Mark Schiffman. To this day, Mark Schiffman is a very good friend of mine. He was he had actually been an instructor in our school, taught me when I was a kid. He left and he opened up his own studio. So now Mark Schiffman and his students are doing a demo in the lobby of the movie theater. So Mark Schiffman, I was always cool with those dudes that were doing the demo. Those were the guys I was competing against in tournaments. I didn't like them at all. So my walk into the movie to see The Perfect Weapon, because it was awesome, because we were 15 years old. We were all full of tusks, all full of you-know-what and vinegar. And now here comes some dude to beat me with a back knuckle in the last tournament that I don't like. His name was Dave, by the way. But anyway, so we walked in giving him all sorts of hard, what are you looking at? Hard looks, you know, and then nothing happened. And then we went to the movie, saw Perfect Weapon. We're like, dude, Grip of Death, you know. So, yeah, Perfect Weapon. I even have fond stories of Perfect Weapon. That's a movie we couldn't wait for. We couldn't wait for it to come out. We were so excited. But anyway.
Yeah, no, that movie was, you know, very huge for Kempo. And yeah, a lot of us, I would say, you know, many, at least of, you know, my and, well, our generation were pretty close in age. Yeah, that movie did a lot for Kempo. So yeah, I'm glad that we were able to have that. So, so to get back on your journey, I'm curious about. So you mentioned that the school that you were training at, you know, started was Tracy's, but then, you know, converted over to the, you know, EPAC style. So, you know, kind of how did that come about, or, you know, are you familiar with how that?
Oh yeah, sure, absolutely. Reasoning behind that. So my studio, you know, being in the suburbs of Philadelphia and being east of the Mississippi means that everything in Kempo through Ed Parker would funnel back to Joe Palanza. You know what I mean? Anybody on this side, hey Ed Parker, I'm gonna learn Kempo. Go to Joe Palanza. So we went to Joe Palanza. I met Joe Palanza for the first time in 1988, and I had never seen anything like it before. The guy moved unbelievable. It was like, you know, and the guy, see, we came from more of like a, it was like an old school hard style. You know, you had like old school stuff, crisp, you know, like guys would go out there and they would do, you know, they would do forms and they would hit a hard bow, you called it, with a reverse punch, and the pop of their gi, you know, which was gray and falling apart, would echo through the entire, it was the loudest thing in the whole wide world. You know what I mean? Those old school crisp, back straight, legs straight, front knee bent, perfect angle, boom, hand on the hip, that kind of stuff. And in comes Joe Polanco, and he, wait, what just happened? You know what I mean? Well, I've never, ever seen anything like that before, you know? So Joe Polanco, my instructor, went under Joe Polanco in the 80s. He actually tested for his fifth degree under Joe Polanco and Ed Parker back in 1988. I remember that because he came in and he had gotten fifth. I didn't understand how things worked. He had gotten his fifth degree black belt, and then he went and he saw Joe Polanco and Ed Parker, and they promoted him. I was like, oh, congratulations! So you're a sixth. He's like, no, I'm a fifth. Yeah, but anyway, he got his fifth from those guys, which is really, really cool. And then Ed Parker used to come around a lot. Unfortunately, I only ever met him once. You know, I was, 15 when he died? I was 15 when he died. So unfortunately, I had other ideas like riding my bike and going to the movies and stuff like that and seeing Ed Parker. But I did meet him once. And at that point, I had never heard Kempo like that before. He whipped stuff out. And I was like, oh, how did that? That was amazing. You know, so yeah, late 80s. So here's the deal. So I'm testing for my black belt. I'm scheduled to test for my black belt February 1989. December 1988, my instructor comes in and goes, hey, everybody, congratulations. Or not congratulations. Hey, everybody, I just want to let you know, effective January 1st, 1989, we're switching over to the Parker system. So all that stuff, this is not what he said, but this is what I heard. All that stuff you've been practicing for your black belt test isn't going to count. It's not going to count, you know. So, but then some stuff is crossover, you know, headlock turned into grip of death, heel toe horse stance turned into neutral bow, hard bow became forward bow, back bow became, you know the drill. Long kimono or kimono grab a queen came long kimono, snapping twig. Well, some of them stay the same. Snapping twigs, just snapping twig, you know. So, 89 is when we switched over to the Parker system. Ed Parker died in 1990. That's a story. I have an Ed Parker passing away story. I only met Ed Parker once, right? I only met Ed Parker once, but he was the man. I mean, everything. Ed Parker was everything. I remember when I met him, my instructor. I have a photo of it. I have a photo of my instructor introducing me. I was a new junior black belt, and Mr. Parker, this is Dan. He's one of our top students, something along those lines. It's like, and I'm looking at Ed Parker. I'm just going, man, this guy. He looks exactly like he does in the books, because I had already read some of the, at least the first Infinite Insights I'd read up to that point. And I'd never met anybody famous before. I was kind of surprised the famous guy looked exactly like he did on the book, you know. And then the next year, December 14th, 1990, was the studio Christmas party. And that day I get promoted to second degree black belt, and I'm co-instructor of the year in my studio. Me and this guy Larry got promoted. He was like my dad's age, you know. So it was a pretty big deal for me, you know. I went home. I ripped my assistant instructor patch right off my get off my gi assist. I can tell you, December 14th, 1990 was the last time this man wore an assistant instructor patch. I ripped that bad boy on. Mom, I need some tape. Put some tape on my second degree black belt. Walked in the karate studio on Monday. Now at this point, I'm teaching karate and getting paid $5 a class to teach. You know, and, I was a pretty popular teacher. You know, so I was looking forward to going in there and getting my due. So I come walking in the door, new second degree black belt in the house. Didn't even do that champ then, but I was ahead of my time. New second degree black belt in the house. And the manager of the school, a guy by the name of Sam Abidi, with his head in his hands. And I instantly know something's wrong. Hey, Sam, what's the matter? He looks at me and he goes, Ed Parker died. I was like, stealing my thunder, Ed Parker? Oh, man, nobody's going to care that I'm instructor of the year at second degree. But I was 15 years old, man. I didn't know any better. The influence that Ed Parker had on my life is greater than nobody else. And the greatest influence that Ed Parker had on my life is after he passed away and we really started traveling, going out on the road and learning Kempo, because, you know, it was tough. It's the only way you're going to learn Kempo. You got to go out. You got to go find it. You can't sit in your karate school and wait for it to come to you. You got to go get it. And we travel on the road. We learn these techniques, you know. But the first couple years after Ed Parker died, these camps were amazing. You have, you know, 300-person camps. You know, me and my training partner, Brian Saul, still to this day, you know, our training partners, 1993, we'll be sitting there looking at celebrities. I'm not going to say the names, but some of them you've interviewed. Hey, look, there's that guy. Oh, man, that's really cool. Hey, check it out. You know, it was a really, really neat thing to behold. And all we ever did was hear all these guys who knew Ed Parker so well talk about how awesome he was, talk about how great he was. I remember Frank Trejo, you know, we were underage, but we snuck into the bar. We snuck into the bar and get to hang out with all the karate guy, you know, the big name karate guys, Frank Trejo, sitting at the bar crying. This is a guy we saw him. He's a corner man in the UFC. You know, he's Frank Trejo. He's crying. I miss Ed Parker. He was so sad. You know, all those people had a significant effect on me. You know, my whole life was dedicated to, learning the man's work. You know, I traveled all over the place. I've been everywhere. I've been everywhere, man. I've trained with every single person. Well, there's a couple left. There's a couple left that I haven't met. There's a couple left. One in your state, Brian Duffy. I haven't met him face to face. I'd like to meet that man. I'd like to meet that man face to face. I admire him. But other than that, I mean, it's pretty much I've met and trained with every single person in Kempo that I care to train with. You know what I mean? And it's just out there trying to get Ed Parker's word, because those first couple years where I missed out, I realized I missed out, and I was behind. I had to make up for it. You know, and that's. I mean, that pretty much lays the groundwork for my journey from about 1992 to right now, you and I talking, and I'm still on the road, man. I'm leaving in a couple of weeks to go to Madrid.
Got a camp in Madrid.
It's going to be pretty cool. My wife and I, it's our 25th anniversary, so we're going to go hang out in Madrid for a couple of days, and then Lorenzo Jimenez, he's got a camp going that weekend, so we'll be down there. So like I said, if you need the knowledge, you got to seek the knowledge. You got to get your butt out of a chair, and you got to travel. You got to go to where the knowledge is, you know. So we'll see what kind of knowledge you can pick up over there.
For sure. So to kind of get back, because I'm curious, since we have kind of a similar trajectory in that, you know, we started in Tracy's and then moved to EPAC. When your school changed over, were you already a black belt at the time, or
was no? So no. So we switched over to Parker in January of '89. So I tested in Tracy. If you did Tracy, I tested in Tracy in February. So I tested and did Tracy stuff. You asked me earlier if I had if karate had taken to me. I will tell you that every test up to that point I had nailed every test up to that point. As a matter of fact, I was kind of catching up to other kids, and it was creating a little bit of a tension because, you know, why is he getting it? I passed a couple kids, you know, I was pretty good at this stuff. I was there every day training hard, nailed every single test. And then you come to my black belt test, February 25th, 1989 is the day I test for my black belt. Ric Flair's 40th birthday. I was a huge wrestling fan at the time. I had the Ric Flair drip going that day. But anyway, I did Mass Attacks. This is what made me think about it. I had Mass Attacks Tracy Ford. Last time I really did Mass Attacks, I started facing the judges, and I ended with my back to the judges. I messed up somewhere. I missed some train. Swinging gate or something like that. Mm-hmm. One of those transitions I missed.
Oh yeah.
And I ended up facing the opposite. Excuse me. I ended up facing the opposite direction, and I'm sitting there going, "That's it. I failed. I'm done." But my instructor's like, "Nah, I know you can do it. Let it go." So yeah. So I tested on Tracy, and then my instructor would give me lessons. You know, we did, and I still do. Since 1989, I've been doing the same thing. I don't do the 24s. I've been doing the 15 systems since 1989. 15 system. All right, if you don't do the 24 system, you don't know Kev. I would beg to differ. I've been doing the 15 system since 1989. So still the same system I teach. So I've. You know, the first 10, that was the Joe Ponzo system at the time. My logic was that, my logic in keeping it around is that that's what he was teaching when Ed Parker was alive. So for me, my logic at the time That was why I kept it. And now you just can't teach an old dog new tricks. But anyway, what would happen is I got my black belt and I would take a private lesson. All right, grip of death. That's a headlock. Okay, obscure wing. That's Japanese stranglehold. But here it's a shoulder grab this way, pin step, elbow, hammer, elbow. Okay, lone kimono's kimono grabs one hand instead of two. You know, mm-hmm. Crossing talent is crossing talent. Keep going. This is thrusting front. This is gift of destruction. You know, this is locking horns. All right, go teach them. So now I'm a black belt. I can remember being in black belt class in our school in 1989. Black belt class Wednesday nights, 8:30 to 9:30. It was all adults and me and like one other kid. And these guys, all black belts. They couldn't believe backbreaker. They made black backbreakers on the blue last technique on the blue belt list. Backbreaker, just going nuts, doing that kind of stuff, you know. So we kind of sped up, learned it quick, and then had to turn around and teach it, which I think that helped. Teaching it helped because forced us to practice it, you know. But we most certainly were at a bit of a handicap when we started, you know, running with the Ed Parker crew, you know, with the Ed Parker Kempo crew, like WKK specifically. We go to WKK and some of the pure Parker guys would look at us like second class. You piece of garbage, Tracy people. You don't know. You know, well, I didn't appreciate that very much. That helped motivate me to travel as well. So we were operating at a deficit and, you know, we had to try and catch up. A lot of good guys that we had to catch up with. Jamie Seabrook, you interviewed him. Jamie Seabrook was not an example of a person who was not pleasant, by the way. Just the way I said that, I don't want that to sound. Jamie Seabrook. Notice he was the first name that came up after I said a lot of good guys. Yeah, so be clear on that. Jamie Seabrook's a good dude, you know what I mean? He was fast as could be. Jamie Seabrook, I met him almost 30 years ago. Dude was fast, you know? Sabor Chan, everybody knows me and Sabor Chan. We hang out together all the time. That dude was insanely fast, you know? Other guys back then, you know, Mark Lawler and Brian Thomas and Steve Arsenault and a lot of good guys on that demo team, you know? Guys, a lot of names, people I'm forgetting, but if, you know, people names, not Dan, oh, Dan Donfra, of course. Dan Donfra was on the demo team, you know? And a lot of good dudes on there, but we had to catch up because we didn't know. So we had to work doubly hard to pick up the techniques, and we did. You know, it was my motivation to have. I'm not going to say I had the whole system down, but I could do every technique in every form from step one to step whatever it needed to be. By the time I was, I don't know, 23 years old, 24 years old, something like that. You know, just getting on the road, and I've been modifying it ever since. I took a lesson with Huck a month ago, and guess what? I'm wrong. That's what I took from it. I'm wrong.
continued learning there. So just wanted to get on one other part of this before we move on to another kind of topic. But when you were doing, you know, this switchover and you're teaching, you know, the Parker techniques, did you just kind of straight teach them, or were you saying, okay, well, you know, we're doing the kimono grab, but you know, now it's this, or did you just,
oh, no, we're Parker people, man. No, we're not garbage Tracy people like everybody looking at us. We're keeping up with the Parkers. There's no used to be. Well, all right, let's not make jokes. Here's the truth of the matter is that after a while, once we learned the Parker techniques, and we taught them straight up, then we would kind of use it as a flex. For those in the room that are Tracy people, I'm like four people, yeah, man, this used to be drawbridge. This used to be headlock A, you know, that kind of stuff. So you would throw that out there. But no, in our studio, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, we had a picture on the wall of Ed Parker. We had a picture on the wall of Remy Prasis. And then we had a picture on the wall of Gitchin Funakoshi. I don't understand why. We did one of the Shotokan forms. We did a little Shotokan. I guess I should throw that out there. My instructor went to college, got a black belt in Shotokan. So we dabbled in some Shotokan forms back in the day. We actually, up until I left that school and went out on my own, we taught the first Heian form, Heian Shodan, we called it Heian 1. we taught that before short form one. Transition number three, short form one, is way tougher than any transition in all 22 of the first Heian form in the Shotokan system. That was the logic, so we taught it. You know, we taught that first. But other than that, we were straight. We were straight Parker. Straight Parker.
Very cool. And then one other thing with that that just popped in my mind. So when there was this, you know, announcement that there was going to be this transition, was there dissension in the school? Where, you know, were there students that had been training there for a while that were like, you know what, I don't want to have to, you know, learn all this new stuff, or did everyone just kind of go with it, or? You know, was there...
So, A, that was 35 years ago, so it's a little foggy, but I don't really remember that. I was one of the younger ones. I was one of the kids that was getting, you know, I was one of the kids that was beating up all the kids in the kids' class, so they put me in the adults, and then all the adults would beat up on me, you know, so I was, you know, a kid standing there swinging upwards in class, so they didn't really talk to me too much about that back then. Back then it was cover your ears. Yeah. You know, so we didn't hear too much about that stuff. But I don't really remember. No, I mean, so no, because we switched to Parker in January of '89. I have a photo of us in a group picture with Ed Parker in May of '89, and they were all there. Okay. They were all there.
Okay.
So, sounds good. So it was. You're leveling up. You're leveling up. So.
Right on. All right, so let's move to the teaching side of it. Can you talk about your early experiences teaching? So just for the listeners, and we discussed a little bit about this before recording, I am, you know, even though I, you know, taught capoeira for many years, I am new to the Kenpo teaching side of it. So I'm interested in hearing kind of any stories you have about your early time in teaching that you can recall
So I'll take you on this journey, and you'll see why I'm saying this might not necessarily be the story that you're expecting to hear, but this is the story I'm going to tell you. This is the truth. So back in 1994, I was running a karate school full-time. That was my job. I was running a karate school full-time. I was the head instructor, you know, and the instructor there was he was pretty much an absentee kind of guy. So I was the show. I was running everything. It was great. I loved it that way. He was out of my way. I'd sit in the big man's chair and teach and all that kind of stuff. Now, by this point, 1994, I had been teaching for 5 years. I started teaching in the late 80s as a young kid. Young. I was young. I was 13 years old. Danny, go teach them short form one. Danny, go teach them. I can remember a very, very, very early memory of me just when I first started teaching class. And there was a kid I was 13 and a kid running the class, Rob Lublin. He's like 17 at the time. And I outranked him, but he was older than me, and he ran class, so it infuriated me because he made me take class and I didn't get to teach. So that was what my level of maturity was when I first started teaching karate. So we fast forward to 1994. I've been taught all through high school. Taught, that's how I made money. I got paid $5 a class and taught all through high school. That was my teaching thing, you know. I went through a phase where I didn't even train, really. I just showed up. I taught, got paid to teach, and left. I didn't train for a couple of years. That happened to coincide with, if you remember, I told you that I used to beat up all the kids in the adult class. I went to the adult class, and the adults used to beat me up. Well, back then, nobody cared about kids, so when I'm saying they used to beat you up, they used to beat you up. So I was like, I think I'm going to work on forms till I get a little bigger. And then I reemerged when I had, you know, eaten a few bowls of mashed potatoes. I took this supplement called Joe Weider's Big. That stuff works great. I'm 49 years old and still putting on weight, so it was pretty effective. But anyway, so 1994, I'm running the karate studio, and there's this girl that I'm absolutely in love with. I'm absolutely in love with, right? And she was in love with me, but we were in that phase where we we didn't admit it. We were friends. We used to teach together and stuff like that. We'd teach together and stuff like that. She was a green belt. I was a brown belt. I was a black belt. And so to find an excuse to hang out with her on a regular basis, I would give her free private lessons on Sundays. And what I did in those private lessons is I would have her. I was above board, you know. And at this point, I should tell you that that same girl, she put the floral arrangement on my. I know this is not a visual. She put the floral arrangement on that table there. We ended up getting married, and we've been married for 30 years. But back then, I would teach her free private lessons, and what I would do is I would make her teach me the techniques. She would teach me the techniques. This is gripping talent. This is how it goes. This is circling the horizon, step off parry, slip, punch to the face. You know, she would teach me all that kind of stuff. Now, she made it to black belt, but of all the lists that she knew, that was the list that she knew best. And why did she know it best? Because she talked it out. She explained it. She thought about it. So you telling me that you're doing a teaching thing, all that's telling me is that you just took the steps to enhance your art even better. What you're going to learn from your students is incredible. Your students are going to ask you questions that you're going to have. You're going to be teaching something you're confident in, and the student's going to go, hey, let me ask you a question from an angle that you never, ever thought about. And you're sitting there as the teacher. I am the all-knowing, all-knowledgeable teacher. And you have to be like, well, huh. And that's something. I we're going to have to work this one out, you know. But the thing is that with this material, you keep teaching the material, and all of a sudden, it's been a long time, man. It's been a long time since I've gotten a new question. Every now and again, you get one. You go, hey, man, good question. I never thought of it that way. You know, usually the questions that you get that are out of left field now are exactly that. They're out of left field. You know, but when you're first coming at it, you approach this, you know, people hit you up, and they approach you in ways that you don't expect, and helps you to expand your horizons. You know, it makes you scratch your head, you know. And as an instructor, if you have the confidence to say, I don't know, that's a tough challenge as an instructor. It's a real tough challenge as an instructor to be confident and look at your students and say, yeah, I don't know. I never thought of it that way. Why don't we sit down and work that out? Why don't we, what do you think? You're asking the question, what do you think? Well, let's, well, you know, maybe you want to look at the way you're shifting your weight here, maybe where your hand goes. You know, you work it out, you learn something. And then what do you do from there? You go find, go to your instructor. And go, hey, man, this is what we were working out. This is what I did with the students. This is what we figured out. Your instructor will go, I asked the question many times, and this is what I came up with. You know, and that's the process. So that's really the thing, my thought process on teaching. You know, it's a great way for you to constantly review the material. Man, how do you remember all that stuff? I teach it all the time. At this point, I have series within. I have lessons within my lessons. And these lessons are called, if you learned this technique from me in 1996, you did it this way. And then the students all do it, and they look at me because they had the benefit of all the knowledge of all the years that I've been training. So they're catching up to speed a lot quicker than I was as I was learning the stuff in my journey. And they look at me like, that's the way you used to teach that? Man, that's ridiculous. So I'm like, yeah, well, that's what made sense to me back then, you know? But then, like I said, go back out on the road, you find a teacher teaches you, you learn, and you keep moving. So I don't know if that's the answer you were looking for, but that's my thought process on teaching.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. So before we head to our lightning round there, can you talk a little bit about you have the International Brotherhood Kenpo? Can you talk a little bit about that? And
yes, yeah. The Brotherhood is, so in order to talk about the Brotherhood, you got to go back to the WKKA. You know, back in the WKKA, you know, WKKA had this demo team, the WKK demo team, you know, and like I said, a lot of quality guys that are out there. Now, at the time, the joke was is that we had this WKK, it's the great WKKA demo team, and we worked all the WKKA events. We just did demos for WKKA people. We never really materialized into anything else, you know, but the thing is that the guys on that team were some good Kempoists, and to this day, continue. I named some of them already, you know. you'll see there's you know, there's a, some of us from time to time, you know, you'll see the red plaque in the background with the WKK demo team with the members and stuff. Like, you see some of the names. Oh, yeah, that guy was, oh, I know that guy. Oh, yeah, I heard of that guy before. But anyway, yeah, due to political purposes, things don't always stay the way they were, the way they are. And there's a bunch of us out there that were what I would like to call free agents. You know, we were affiliated with an association, and now all of a sudden, for whatever reasons, we're no longer affiliated. You know, I remember I got a report after I got the boot that Mark Lawler had said to a guy, Tony 40, who was around back then. And Mark Lawler said to him, he goes, there's three people missing from this event right now, Sabora Chan, Dan Mack, and Dan Donfra. This is pretty, this is a story someone told me a long, long time after I had been kicked out. Hey, this is what they're saying about you. So it's very, very heartfelt. So, you know, you hear that and you can kind of see, if you look at the brotherhood, you can see those are the roots, you know. So we all kind of went on our separate ways. You know, I had gotten very soured to the Kempo world and all the politics, you know. I did what I believed was everything right, and I was not rewarded for it. I was punished for it, which at the time was very, very scary to me. I didn't know what to do. I was all by myself, you know what I mean? That's where Frank Trail comes into play. But anyway, we still kept in contact, and it was good timing. You know, we were all, we were kind of in that period where we were all having kids. So it worked out well. We all kind of had kids. We kind of all went our separate ways. But, you know, like, I wanted to. Look, here we go. You're talking to me, so I'm going to take as much credit for this as I can. I really believe that I was the one who helped bring the band back together. Now, I wasn't necessarily the one with the vision, but I was like, hey, guys, let's hang out, you know? And then Sabora was like, well, what if we do this? You know? And that's how it started. But what I was going to say was, yeah, I got out of the karate world for a while, and I just taught a couple students. That was it. I just taught a couple students. And there's one guy, Steve Arsenault. I said to him, I said, listen, if you go out on your own, Steve Arsenault and I have long since parted our ways. I wish him nothing but the best, but he and I have long since parted our ways. But at the time, he and I were pretty close to the WKK, and I said, look, when you're out of WKK, if you leave, hit me up. I'll come support you. I wasn't allowed in WKK anymore, so I'll come support you. He's a good dude. So I started hanging out. Steve Arsenault had this little Kempo group back then. I used to hang out with them, and I would talk to Sabor. Come on, man. Come on up. Let's teach. Let's go. He's asking us to teach. Let's go up and teach with him. Sabor's like, I don't know about that, man. I said, yeah, come on. Let's teach. You know, so Sabor starts teaching up there. Frank Trejo, you know, we reconnected with Frank Trejo. We knew from the WKK days. I disappeared, come back. Frank Trejo's in the mix. Eventually ended up going under Frank Trejo, and he was – greatest influence ever for me. But anyway, so Sabor and I were sitting there one night. We used to talk late at night, and he said, hey man, why don't we, we're doing seminars and stuff like that. I just reopened a school. It's going well. We had done a couple camps informal, and he goes, why don't we start our own organization? And I was like, organization? You can't start an organization. Organization in Kempo at the time was like Voldemort. That was a word that does not get spoken. You do not organization the cojones on this, man. Why don't we just kind of do some seminars, man? Sports are like, all right, well, why don't we do some seminars? It doesn't have to be an organization. Let's call it the Brotherhood. So he had a little foresight into this. Now, just to give you a little bit of my history with Sabora, we were in the WKKA. We're in the WKKA now. I had mentioned before that when I was a kid, I was coming, before I even started karate, I was watching Karate Kid. And I said that there was that scene, that aerial shot where they go up in the air and you see the kids in the tournament. There's the one kid in the foreground. So now I'm on the WKKA demo team with Sabora Chan. Turns out Sabora Chan is that kid from Karate Kid. He's that kid. That's what I have to compete with, man. That's a bunch of crap. The dude was super duper fast. I didn't like it, not one bit, but I admired it. He was good, man. He was good. And look, here's the deal. If I want to, I don't want to hang out with people that I'm better than. And what good is that? I want to be associated with people that are better than me. It's no fun hanging out with, you know what I mean? So I started hanging out with dudes. Like I said, for me, my motivation for the Brotherhood is I wanted to put on seminars from, people that I would want to learn from. You know, and the thing was is that I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say this because I feel it's important, because this informed me. I'm not going to tell people that not to do all the right things, right? I'm going to tell people that I felt like I did all the right stuff. I followed all the rules. I was super duper loyal. I could tell you a lot of stories to back up how loyal I was and the things that I did. And I got the boot. And when I got the boot, you know what I decided? I decided, hey, you know, I did everything the way they told me was the right way to do things. Now I'm going to do things the way I want to do things, and the hell with them. Pardon my friends, but the hell with them. I'm definitely a very colorful guy with the expletives. I've been doing a reel. I'm proud of myself for how well I've been censoring myself, but the hell with them. And I said it a lot more colorful than that. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to do my own thing. You know, and in the old days, the thing was, is if you wanted to do something to bring you legitimacy, get a higher rank. I'm going to do something. I want to look legitimate. Get a higher rank. Bring the higher rank in. Because if you get a higher rank, you're like, hey, look at me. I'm friends with this higher rank. You know, there's a lot of people. This is my higher rank. Hey, everybody, I'm friends with this. Look how cool I am because I'm friends with this higher rank. Well, what we did, and we kind of didn't recognize it at the time, but it became apparent pretty quick because we were shocked by the support. I don't know why we'd be shocked by the support. I got to be honest with you. I'm pretty confident in myself. And like I told you, I thought Sabor was better than me. So why wouldn't people be interested? But, I, you know, it's natural, you know. But people started coming. Man, did they start coming. They started supporting us. And all of a sudden, I recognized is that, you know what? I think my legitimacy is going to come from below, from the students that are supporting me and say, hey, man, we're interested in what Dan Mech has to say. You know, that was very, very refreshing. That was really, really cool, you know? And, it's pretty neat. It's pretty neat experience to have, you know, when you run events and people are getting on planes and flying to see you, you know? And it's not because I'm Mr. Super Duke, because my neutral bow is, you know what? Let me tell you something. My neutral bow is so good. That's not it. You know what I mean? It's in the name. It's the brotherhood. Come chill. What association you? I don't care. You do Kempo? Yeah, you're going to be cool. You're not going to be a jerk. You're going to be a jerk. You're not going to be a jerk. All right, come on in, man. Let's hang out. It's a whole bunch of not jerks hanging out and doing Kempo and having fun. That's what the brotherhood is. That's what should be our tagline is. We're a bunch of guys that aren't jerks. We just like to hang out and have fun. If you're going to bring a bunch of drama, get out of here. Drama is what did before. You know, when we had to deal with drama and politics, look at politics. I'm not going to get into it. You understand? Everybody hears politics, and all of a sudden, the rear end's pucker. What if we have no politics? It's just Kempo. Just train. We caused some drama a couple years ago because we posted a picture, and what we did is that this event, we had all these different lineages, and they happened to be represented on the back of their shirt, the back of their gi. So we posted. Bing, bang, bing, bang, bing, bang, boom. There might have been a Brotherhood logo in there, too. There probably was. You know, you got to be smart with marketing and all that crap, but that's not what it was about. It was about the fact that, look, we're all just cool, man. We all want to train. That's the purpose behind the round table. The round table that we did, that was really awesome. Anyway, real quick, going back to the to finish the brotherhood. So Sabora hits me up. He says, let's do this. And we had a few different iterations of the brotherhood over the years when we were kind of trying to figure ourselves out. You know, I will stand that every single person that ever represented the brotherhood as an instructor, I truly believe that they have something to offer to the Kempo community. You know, some of them are really good, you know. But anyway, point is that sometimes personalities don't work out. I'm not saying that these guys were jerks. I'm just saying sometimes personalities don't work out. I had a conversation with Larry Tatum. I will tell you this. This is 100% true story. I had a conversation with Larry Tatum, just me and him in the car. And I said, we're starting this thing called the Brotherhood. And he goes, you guys aren't going to last. That's what he told me. It's the truth. You guys aren't going to last. He goes, I've seen it a million times. Your egos are going to get in the way. And it's going to fall apart in a few years. Well, I'm talking to you about almost 13 years later. And not all the iterations of the Brotherhood lasted, you know, and there's definitely been some bumps along the way. But in the end, we have our core crew, you know, myself, Sabora, Angelo, Dan Donfro, Brian Saul, Dave Gigliotti. We're really the core. You know, we're really the core. And if you dig into that, you have different lineage is right within there, you know. We all have our crews, and then some of us will go back to other crews, you know. Dave Gigliotti is very, very active in the IKCA. We're very friendly with the people in the IKCA because you know what the IKCA is? A group full of people that aren't jerks. They're all good people, man. They're all nice people. They have a great attitude. Dave Gigliotti is a spectacular person. You know what I mean? And he's part of the crew. So that's really the heart of the brotherhood, you know. And then you have the people that support us, you know, people that are always around, you know, Laura Eckert and Paul Bulk, the Schenectady crew, Jeff Blay, those guys, you know, they're always training, Cheryl and, you know, there's a bunch of people all over the place down in Deerfield, Alex's crew, all those guys, you know. So just hooked up with Randy and his crew. They're good people. You know, you just meet good people. You just travel and train. You know, back in the day, the WKK was a bunch of weekends where we would get together, hang out, and do Kempo. We'd get together, hang out, and do Kempo. When we were done doing Kempo, we'd all go into our hotel rooms with a bunch of people, and we would all hang out and party, and we would tell Kempo stories. We'd tell jokes until security would yell at us, and then we would go to another room, and we would just keep going. You know what I mean? Some of the best jokes and some of the best Kempo I ever learned was in rooms after camps. So the brotherhood is just us traveling around and just recreating that weekend over and over and over and over again. That's what we do. Just train and have fun. Smile with good people.
Very nice. That's very nice. I like that.
And let me just say that, you know, if I forgot anybody, I apologize if I didn't say anybody's names. I'm just kind of operating shooting from the hip here. So people tell me that I'm a good storyteller. I got some stories that I'm used to telling that right I have on. Owned. This isn't one of them yet.
Right on. Well, we'll definitely have to get those stories in part two and three and four and as we go along. But let's move on to our lightning round here. So got a few questions for you. So. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Do I have a favorite technique? I would say that my favorite technique switches. You know, snapping twigs was my favorite technique for a while. I would say, you know what, here's the deal. I would say right now, my favorite technique is a series that we have in my studio called the Pete Townsend Series. So we call it the Pete. You know, yeah, you have family groupings. Well, there are special family groupings in the Dan Mack lineage that don't get out there. This is one that'll get out there. We have the Pete Townsend series. So Pete Townsend was the guitar player for The Who, right? We don't give food again. And he would swing his arm all the way through. And he would swing his arm all the way through, just like deflecting hammer, just like defying the storm, just like hooking wings, just like snapping twig, just like the treating pendulum. All these techniques you're doing the Pete Townsend. So that's my favorite group of techniques right now. As far as a favorite technique is concerned, I can't say I do. Maybe crossing town. So versatile.
All right. Good answer. I like it. All right. Do you have a favorite?
Too fast. It's the lightning round. Should I be quicker? It's the lightning
oh,
round.
Oh, no.
Should I
no,
be like
no,
one
no.
word? Boom.
No. I just kind of picked that for now as a way to. I don't know. That's just the name that I decided on for this part of the show. May change later on, but we'll see.
I like it. I have a lightning round in my garage, right? Too. I have a lightning round. But anyway, go ahead. What else? What do we got?
So next question is: do you have a favorite form and or set?
Favorite form and or set. So short three is the only form I won first place with when I was a blue belt when I was about 12. That's the last time I won forms.
Very nice.
So short three for that reason.
Very nice. I like it. Right. Next question. If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
Non-fictional.
I should say besides Ed Parker. Since this is a Kempo show, I get to meet Parker,
but I definitely would have trained him more. In terms of lives, no, before as soon as the question came out, the first thing that popped into my mind was Damian Asada. That's I've never met that man, and that's a man that I really, really wish. And I've almost caught him a couple times, and it just didn't seem to work out. And I know he's getting up there in years, but I hope to meet that man because that guy's unbelievable. Fictional. Who would I want to train with? That'd be fictional. Yoda, no question. Yoda.
Very nice. All right, and then our last question, and I'm this is kind of a newer question for the show, and I'm still kind of workshopping it. But do you have a recommendation, a martial arts recommendation? So this could be the parameters of it is anything. It could be a book, a movie, a video game, a school, a teacher, just any martial arts related recommendation that you would want to throw out there for the listeners and myself to seek out.
Something tangible or just something tangible or philosophical, or what do you mean?
Anything you want. Keep it open.
I can't stress the importance of practice. I tell my kids a story. I say, I want to tell you guys about knowledge. You come into the karate studio and you acquire knowledge. And then you leave and you bring that knowledge home with you. But here's the thing, is that knowledge gets lonely. And if you don't entertain that knowledge, if you don't spend time with that knowledge, if you don't play with that knowledge, it's going to get bored and do what? Zip, right back to the studio. So now you got to come to class again, and now you got to try and catch that knowledge again, right? And you don't know. I mean, that piece of knowledge might not come back again for a while. Like so it. When you get a piece of knowledge, you need to go home and you need to entertain it. And don't let that knowledge get lonely, because if that knowledge gets lonely, where is it going? Right back to the dojo, right back to the studio. All right. So keep that knowledge well entertained.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. So we are now at the our final part of the show here. So now is your time for shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything you want, or just say anything that maybe we didn't cover. Just anything else that you wanted to put out there. You have the floor, and we'll close out with that.
shameless self promotion. Look us up on Facebook if you're not already. Find us on Facebook. You know, as a group, the International Brotherhood of Kenpo Karate. We got a page that's pretty active. Again, no jerks. We don't do that. We shut that down. Somebody posts something online and immediately people are like, dude, you're neutral, Bosa, gone. None of them here. We don't have time for that crap. You know what I mean? We're not clappity clap. Everybody gets a trophy people either, but on the internet in front of the world isn't the place to say that kind of stuff. So our page online is a nice positive page where a lot of people share. There's some good knowledge on there and just good basic general stuff. And then we're pretty much done for the year. But, we do seminars throughout the year. We have Madrid coming up. It's just outside of Madrid. Lorenzo Jimenez is the person to contact for that. Next year we have pretty sure we have Deerfield, Florida in February. That's what we've been doing every year there. And then we have the WKK camp in Maryland, which will be in the March kind of area. June, I'll throw a plug out. Usually Dave Gigliotti up in Connecticut brings Chuck Sullivan in, and we usually do something with those guys up there. So that's not set in stone yet, but we do that usually every year. And then Dan Donfro in Dartmouth, Massachusetts in the fall. And then also Randy Kuhn down in Orlando. So we're down there in Orlando. And we haven't been out to California in a couple years. So there's some rumblings about a California camp maybe happening. And there's some other things on the horizon. So we're always just looking to get together and train. We're just always looking to get together and train with people. I'm available if anybody wants to hit me up. You can reach me on Facebook, facebook.com/Dan Meck, or you can email me, danmeckkempo@gmail.com. If you email me, I'll get back to you within a month. If you hit me up on Messenger on Facebook, I'll get back to you pretty quick. Reggie, you can attest to that. I got back to you pretty quick, you know, so hit me up on Facebook. And yeah, that's about it. That's about it. You know, that's all we have. So I really appreciate you hitting me up and giving me the opportunity to come on here. Like I said, I think it's great what you're doing. I'm very much open to another one of these. If somewhere down the road you're stuck, I had Frank Soto, good dude. Frank Soto's doing real good work. I don't know if you've seen any of his stuff, but he's out there, he's kicking butt. And and he had a time once where he had a guest cancel on him, and he hit me up. He's like, hey man, can you come on? And I came on, and it was myself and Damian Abbott from England. We came on and just kind of did an impromptu thing. So yeah, man, I'm definitely, now that I'm on your wavelength, I'm going to pay attention. I have the Apple Podcast app, so I will listen to your podcasts. And I'm a fan, man. I'm a new fan. So I salute you, and good luck with your long form three.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to be on with me. And I like hearing your story and your journey. And yeah, we'll definitely have to have you back on again, and we can get on some more specific topics. And yeah, just learn and grow together. And once again, yeah, it's just thank you so much for being on. And can't wait to get this out for everyone to hear the story. And yeah, thank you.
Good deal. Thank you so much. I salute. Boom.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.